Well, hello. We continue tonight in this long chapter. Chapter 14, the origin and remedy of falsehood and error, wrong and evil. And I believe one of the large points that Sri Aurobindo was making in the last is that despite the omnipresence of the Chit Shakti, the consciousness force, which is ever-present and omnipresent, that in the manifestation, it stations itself as a secret consciousness behind, but poses itself as a surface nescience. This is the first ignorance that we deal with, rising out of this nescience back into consciousness. The second is, of course, the separativity that comes with the emergence of the ego. It is these two things, the surface nescience and the arisal of the ego, which lead to wrong, and from wrong to deliberate wrong, which is evil, but always based on this clouding of the consciousness and this misperception of oneself as being separate from others. So we begin where we left off, as Sri Aurobindo was reaching for the old Sankhyan terminology to express these realities that he's describing here in the classifications of nature as Indian philosophy has understood it from ages immemorial. So we take it up from here. In the terms of the Sankhya psychology, we can distinguish three types of mental individuality. That which is governed by the principle of obscurity and inertia, first born of the inconscience, tamasic. That which is governed by a force of passion and activity, kinetic, rajasic. That which is cast in the mold of the sattvic principle of light, harmony, balance. So these are the three gunas of nature. Nature is Prakriti, she who builds and constructs. She uses these three qualities, a principle of stability, but which is also one of inertia, tamas, a principle of energy, but which is also passionate and not very capable of self-regulation, rajas, and then, of course, a principle of light and balance, of equilibrium, but which can't really bring order to the other two, sattva. So these three constitute every single thing in nature, according to the Sankhyan view. So if we're describing nature, then we refer to these terms to get coloration of the field of phenomena that we see and begin to understand the classification of things in this way. He says, the tamasic intelligence, so this intelligence colored by the principle of inertia, the tamasic intelligence has its seat in the physical mind. Well, this is the mind absorbed in the physical. This isn't to be misconstrued as the mental physical. This is the physical mind. The mind as it operates in the world of matter. The tamasic intelligence has its seat in the physical mind. It is inert to ideas, except to those which it receives inertly, blindly, passively, from a recognized source or authority, obscure in their reception, unwilling to enlarge itself, recalcitrant to new stimulus, conservative and immobile. It clings to its received structure of knowledge, and its one power is repetitive practicality. But it is a power limited by the accustomed, the obvious, the established and familiar, and already secure. It thrusts away all that is new and likely to disturb it. So he's describing here the psychology of what this tamasic principle is as it operates in the physical mind. All of this, of course, is describing the field of the ignorance. So first, tamas, inert, slow, secure. The rajasic intelligence has its main seat in the vital mind. The mind as it is focused on life energy, and is of two kinds. One kind is defensive, with violence and passion, assertive of its mental individuality and all that is in agreement with it, preferred by its volition, adapted to its outlook, but aggressive against all that is contrary to its mental ego structure or unacceptable to its personal intellectuality. The other kind is enthusiastic for new things, passionate, insistent, impetuous, often mobile beyond measure, inconstant and ever restless, governed in its idea not by truth and light, but by the zest of intellectual battle and movement and adventure. So the rajasic can be either defensive or enthusiastic. The sattvic intelligence is eager for knowledge, as open as it can be to it, careful to consider and verify and balance, to adjust and adapt to its view whatever confirms itself as truth, receiving all that it can assimilate, skillful to build truth in a harmonious intellectual structure, but because its light is limited, as all mental light must be, it is unable to enlarge itself so as to receive equally all truth and all knowledge. It has a mental ego, even an enlightened one, and is determined by it in its observation, judgment, reasoning, mental choice, and preference. In most men, there is a predominance of one of these qualities, but also a mixture. The same mind can be open and plastic and harmonic in one direction, kinetic and vital, hasty and prejudiced and ill-balanced in another, and yet another, obscure and unreceptive. This limitation by personality, this defense of personality and refusal to receive what is unassimilable, is necessary for the individual being because, in its evolution at the stage reached, it has a certain self-expression, a certain type of experience and use of experience which must, for the mind and life at least, govern nature. That, for the moment, is its law of being, its dharma. So we can be basically tamasic, we can be fundamentally rajasic, or we can be sattvic. We're going to be all of these in the mixture according to nature. You can't be just one. You're going to have all, and different characteristics of you will express one or the other, but according to a kind of personality which is formed, which is a natural formation, but necessary for the moment. So that is our dharma. It's the law of our being at that time. It will be impossible to shake it altogether because it is the cast of nature that our soul has chosen for this incarnation. This limitation of mind consciousness by personality and of truth by mental temperament and preference must be the rule of our nature so long as the individual has not reached universality, is not yet preparing for mind transcendence. But it is evident that this condition is inevitably a source of error and can, at any moment, be the cause of a falsification of knowledge, an unconscious or half-willful self-deception, a refusal to admit true knowledge, a readiness to assert acceptable wrong knowledge as true knowledge. I know the moment must seem particularly attuned to these sentences, but remember, he's writing these for all times, for all climes. This is in the field of cognition. So, psychology. But the same law applies to will and action. Out of ignorance, a wrong consciousness is created, which gives a wrong dynamic reaction to the contact of persons, things, happenings. The surface consciousness develops the habit of ignoring, misunderstanding, or rejecting the suggestions to action or against action that come from the secret inmost consciousness, the psychic entity. It answers instead to unenlightened mental and vital suggestions, or acts in accordance with the demands and impulsions of the vital ego. Here, the second of the primary conditions of the evolution, the law of a separate life being affirming itself in a world which is not self to it, comes into prominence and assumes an immense importance. It is here that the surface vital personality or life self asserts its dominance, and this dominance of the ignorant vital being is a principal active source of discord and harmony, a cause of inner and outer perturbations of the life, a mainspring of wrongdoing and evil. So if our surface personality ignores the soul's prompting, well, the vital ego is more than willing to step in and lean into any situation. But it brings with it definite disharmony, an element of discord, and leads to what we call wrongdoing and evil. The natural vital element in us, insofar as it is unchecked or untrained or retains its primitive character, is not concerned with truth or right consciousness or right action. It is concerned with self-affirmation, with life growth, with possession, with satisfaction of impulse, with all satisfactions of desire. This main need and demand of the life self seems all important to it. It would readily carry it out without any regard to truth or right or good or any other consideration. But because mind is there and has these conceptions, because the soul is there and has these soul perceptions, it tries to dominate mind and get from it by dictation a sanction and order of execution for its own will of self-affirmation, a verdict of truth and right and good for its own vital assertions, impulses, desires. It is concerned with self-justification in order that it may have room for full self-affirmation. So the vital would love to dominate the mind and dictate to it what it will think so that it can justify its own ends. But if it can get the assent of mind, it is quite ready to ignore all these standards and set up only one standard, the satisfaction, growth, strength, greatness of the vital ego. The life individual needs place, expansion, possession of its world, dominance and control of things and beings. It needs life room, a space in the sun, self-assertion, survival. It needs these things for itself and for those with whom it associates itself, for its own ego and for the collective ego. It needs them for its ideas, creeds, ideals, interests, imaginations, for it has to assert these forms of I-ness and my-ness and impose them on the world around it, or, if it is not strong enough to do that, it has at least to defend and maintain them against others to the best of its power and contrivance. It may try to do it by methods it thinks or chooses to think or represent as right. It may try to do it by the naked use of violence, ruse, falsehood, destructive aggression, crushing of other life formations. The principle is the same, whatever the means or the moral attitude. It is not only in the realm of interests, but in the realm of ideas and the realm of religion that the vital being of man has introduced this spirit and attitude of self-affirmation and struggle and the use of violence, oppression and suppression, intolerance, aggression. It has imposed the principle of life egoism on the domain of intellectual truth and the domain of the spirit. Into its self-affirmation, the self-asserting life brings in hatred and dislike towards all that stands in the way of its expansion or hurts its ego. It develops as a means or as a passion or reaction of the life nature, cruelty, treachery, and all kinds of evil. Its satisfaction of desire and impulse takes no account of right and wrong, but only of the fulfillment of desire and impulse. For this satisfaction, it is ready to face the risk of destruction and the actuality of suffering. For what it is pushed by nature to aim at is not self-preservation alone, but life affirmation and life satisfaction, formulation of life force and life being. So I'll let you take a breath and reflect on current political leadership, if you like, while we prepare for the next paragraph. It does not follow that this is all that the vital personality is in its native composition, or that evil is its very nature. It is not primarily concerned with truth and good, but it can have the passion for truth and good as it has more spontaneously the passion for joy and beauty. In all that is developed by the life force, there is developed at the same time a secret delight somewhere in the being, a delight in good and a delight in evil, a delight in truth and a delight in falsehood, a delight in life and an attraction to death, a delight in pleasure and a delight in pain, in one's own suffering and the suffering of others, but also in one's own joy and happiness and good and the joy and happiness and good of others. For the force of life affirmation affirms alike the good and the evil. It has its impulses to help and association, of generosity, affection, loyalty, self-giving. It takes up altruism as it takes up egoism, sacrifices itself as well as destroys others. And in all its acts, there is the same passion for life affirmation, the same force of action and fulfillment. This character of vital being and its trend of existence, in which what we term good and evil are items but not the mainspring, is evident in subhuman life. In the human being, since there is a mental, moral, and psychic discernment has developed. Since there a mental, moral, and psychic discernment has developed, it is subjected to control or to camouflage, but it does not change its character. The vital being and its life force and their drive towards self-affirmation are, in the absence of an overt action of soul power and spiritual power, Atma Shakti, nature's chief means of effectuation, and without its support, neither mind nor body can utilize their possibilities or realize their aim here in existence. It is only if the inner or true vital being replaces the outer life personality that the drive of the vital ego can be wholly overcome and the life force become the servant of the soul and a powerful instrumentation for the action of our true spiritual being. This is a central point. We cannot accomplish anything in life. The body cannot achieve its inherent divinity, cannot disclose it. The mind cannot fulfill what it envisions without the power of the life force to fuel it, to drive it. So unless we can summon the Atma Shakti, that is the power of Chit, coming into play directly, then we have to use the life force, vitality, as an intermediary. But what we have to do is secure a transition from the outer life personality to the inner. We have to find our true vital being and learn to live from that. That can be an ally to the psychic, a servant of the soul, and become the instrument of the true spiritual being. And he'll develop this point later in the book. This, then, is the origin and nature of error, falsehood, wrong, and evil in the consciousness and will of the individual. A limited consciousness growing out of nescience is the source of error. A personal attachment to the limitation and the error born of it, the source of falsity. A wrong consciousness governed by the life ego, the source of ego. Pardon me, the source of evil. So this is essentially a point that he made several paragraphs ago, but now he's come back to it having traversed the whole field of Indian psychology as expressed through the Sankhyan terminology. So you might want to put a double asterisk next to that because it's an important passage. But it is evident that their relative existence is only a phenomenon thrown up by the cosmic force in its drive towards evolutionary self-expression. And it is there that we have to look for the significance of the phenomenon. So if out of ignorance, error, falsehood, wrong, and evil arise, we have to see what the purpose of it is in the cosmic vision. For the emergence of the life ego is, as we have seen, a machinery of cosmic nature for the affirmation of the individual, for his self-disengagement from the indeterminate mass substance of the subconscient, for the appearance of a conscious being on a ground prepared by the inconscience. The principle of life affirmation of the ego is the necessary consequence. The individual ego is a pragmatic and effective fiction, a translation of the secret self into the terms of surface consciousness, or a subjective substitute for the true self in our surface experience. Either way you express it, you arrive at the same result. It is separated by ignorance from other self and from the inner divinity. but it is still pushed secretly towards an evolutionary unification in diversity. It has behind itself, though finite, the impulse to the infinite. But this, in the terms of an ignorant consciousness, translates itself into the will to expand, to be a boundless finite, to take everything it can into itself, to enter into everything and possess it, even to be possessed if by that it can feel itself satisfied and growing in or through others, or can take into itself by subjection the being and power of others, or get thereby a help or an impulse for its life affirmation, its life delight, its enrichment of its mental, vital, or physical existence. So the soul has the impulse to the infinite, even though masked by the ego. But because it does these things as a separate ego for its separate advantage and not by conscious interchange and mutuality, not by unity, life discord, conflict, disharmony arise. And it is the products of this life discord and disharmony that we call wrong and evil. Nature accepts them, because they are necessary circumstances of the evolution, necessary for the growth of the divided being. They are products of ignorance, supported by an ignorant consciousness that founds itself on division, by an ignorant will that works through division, by an ignorant delight of existence that takes the joy of division. The evolutionary intention acts through the evil as through the good. It has to utilize all, because confinement to a limited good would imprison and check the intended evolution. It uses any available material and does what it can with it. This is the reason why we see evil coming out of what we call good and good coming out of what we call evil. And if we see even what was thought to be evil coming to be accepted as good, what was thought to be good accepted as evil, it is because our standards of both are evolutionary, limited, and mutable. Evolutionary nature, the terrestrial cosmic force, seems then at first to have no preference for either of these opposites. It uses both alike for its purpose. And yet, it is the same nature, the same force that has burdened man with the sense of good and evil and insists on its importance. Nature has no preferences, but uses both to deliver a greater and real good. It accepts wrong and evil as necessary to experience along the pathway to get to this greater good. Evidently, therefore, this sense also has an evolutionary purpose. It too must be necessary. It must be there so that man may leave certain things behind him, move towards others until out of good and evil he can emerge into some good that is eternal and infinite. So this is a summation of what he's argued to this point, that this immersion in ignorance, this arisal from superficial existence, moving through separative ego to experience wrong and error, to arrive from falsehood back at a growing truth that leads to an ultimate good, is a necessary process of nature as she uncoils out of her involution and arcs back to her origination, and her destined point of delivery is this expression of the all in the one again. But now, if this is its goal, how do we do it? But how is this evolutionary intention in nature to fulfill itself? By what power, means, impulsion? What principle and process of selection and harmonization? The method adopted by the mind of man through the ages has been always a principle of selection and rejection. And this has taken the forms of a religious sanction, a social or moral rule of life, or an ethical ideal. But this is an empirical means which does not touch the root of the problem because it has no vision of the cause and origin of the malady it attempts to cure. It deals with the symptoms, but deals with them perfunctorily, not knowing what function they serve in the purpose of nature and what it is in the mind and life that supports them and keeps them in being. Moreover, human good and evil are relative, and the standards erected by ethics are uncertain as well as relative. What is forbidden by one religion or another? What is regarded as good or bad by social opinion? What is thought useful to society or noxious to it? What some temporary law of man allows or disallows? What is or is considered helpful or harmful to self or others, what accords with this or that ideal, what is prompted or discouraged by an instinct which we call conscience. An amalgam of all these viewpoints is the determining heterogeneous idea, constitutes the complex substance of morality. In all of them, there is the constant mixture of truth and half-truth and error, which pursues all the activities of our limiting mental knowledge-ignorance. A mental control over our vital and physical desires and instincts, over our personal and social action, over our dealings with others, is indispensable to us as human beings, and morality creates a standard by which we can guide ourselves and establish a customary control. But the control is always imperfect, and it is an expedient, not a solution. Man remains always what he is and has ever been, a mixture of good and evil, sin and virtue, a mental ego with an imperfect command over his mental, vital, and physical nature. So yes, we construct an ethical system, we construct a morality, because it is necessary for us to improve, to move towards this ultimate good that we envision. But we know that its selection of this or that as being a good, and a permanent good at that, is a relative and impermanent choice. We will outgrow it, and we will outgrow this limited mind that currently is the leader of our lives. We will evolve beyond it. Not perhaps tonight, but soon. So we'll put our bookmarks there, and remember that next Sunday, instead of working in the life divine, we're going to take up Sri Aurobindo's magnificent little book, The Mother, and cover it in a summary way, focusing mostly on the sixth chapter. So we have typically done this in the month of February. It has always been a delight to do it. It brings felicity to us. So next Sunday, it'll be 2 days, I guess, in advance of the mother's birthday, the 21st of February, but that day we will select and cover the mother. And we'll return to the life divine and finish the chapter in subsequent weeks. Tonight, from Savitri, I have a selection which illustrates some of what we read about in the life divine tonight. So these are not the most sublime lines that Sri Aurobindo has written, but as a great poet does, he describes the nature of the world as it is. And so some of the aspects of ignorant consciousness as it emerges in life and pushes beyond into mind has to be described if you're going to delineate the nature of the cosmic journey. So this is a section from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. Beings were there who wore a human form. Absorbed, they lived in the passion of the scene, but knew not who they were or why they lived. Content to breathe, to feel, to sense, to act. Life had for them no aim save nature's joy and the stimulus and delight of outer things. Identified with the spirit's outward shell, they worked for the body's wants. They craved no more. The veiled spectator, watching from their depths, fixed not his inward eye upon himself, nor turned to find the author of the plot. He saw the drama only and the stage. There was no brooding stress of deeper sense. The burden of reflection was not borne. Mind looked on nature with unknowing eyes, adored her boons and feared her monstrous strokes. It pondered not on the magic of her laws. It thirsted not for the secret wells of truth, but made a register of crowding facts and strung sensations on a vivid thread. It hunted and it fled and sniffed the winds, or slothed inert in sunshine and soft air. It sought the engrossing contacts of the world, but only to feed the surface sense with bliss. These felt life's quiver in the outward touch. They could not feel behind the touch, the soul. To guard their form of self from nature's harm, to enjoy and to survive, was all their care. The narrow horizon of their days was filled with things and creatures that could help and hurt. The world's values hung upon their little self. Isolated, cramped in the vast unknown, to save their small lives from surrounding death, they made a tiny circle of defense against the siege of the huge universe. They preyed upon the world and were its prey, but never dreamed to conquer and be free. Obeying the world power's hints and firm taboos, a scanty part they drew from her rich store. There was no conscious code and no life plan. The patterns of thinking of a little group fixed a traditional behavior's law. Ignorant of soul, save as a wraith within, tied to a mechanism of unchanging lives and to a dull, usual sense and feelings beat, they turned in grooves of animal desire. In walls of stone, fenced round, they worked and warred, did by a banded selfishness a small good, or wrought a dreadful wrong and cruel pain on sentient lives and thought they did no ill. Ardent from the sack of happy, peaceful homes and gorged with slaughter, plunder, rape, and fire, they made of human selves their helpless prey A drove of captives led to lifelong woe, or torture a spectacle made and holiday, mocking or thrilled by their torn victims' pangs, admiring themselves as titans and as gods. Proudly they sang their high and glorious deeds and praised their victory and their splendid force. An animal in the instinctive herd, pushed by life impulses, forced by common needs, each in his own kind saw his ego's glass. All served the aim and action of the pack. Those like himself, by blood or custom kin, to him were parts of his life, his adjunct selves, his personal nebula's constituent stars, satellite companions of his solar eye. A master of his life's environment, a leader of a huddled human mass, herding for safety on a dangerous earth, he gathered them round him as if minor powers to make a common front against the world, or weak and sole on an indifferent earth, as a fortress for his undefended heart, or else to heal his body's loneliness. In others than his kind, he sensed a foe, an alien, unlike force to shun and fear, a stranger and adversary to hate and slay. Or he lived as lives the solitary brute. At war with all, he bore his single fate. Onwards, upwards. Namaste, Jai Ma.